painting to photography, from beadwork to woodworking. KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University presents Artbeat. Artbeat highlights the work and accomplishments of local artists from in and around Winona. Support for Artbeat is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
On today's Artbeat, Terry Tenseth talks to Paul Barnes, producing director of the Great River Shakespeare Festival and 2010 winner of the Kevin Kline Award for Outstanding Director of a Play for his work on Amadeus with the Repertory Theater of St. Louis. Here's Terry Tenseth with Paul Barnes on today's Artbeat.
I'm Terry Tenseth, and today I have director Paul Barnes with me from the Great River Shakespeare Festival, also known as the head honcho of the festival. That's what I like to call you.
Excellent. I don't quite know what that means, but I'll take it as a compliment.
Good. When did you come up with this idea for the festival or get involved with the festival?
The first conversation we had about starting a Shakespeare festival somewhere in the state of Minnesota was actually on April 30th, 2002. And I remember that date because I was in Minneapolis. I was directing a project at the BFA Actor Training Program at the University of Minnesota / Guthrie Theater. And a set designer in the Twin Cities who I'd worked with at the Commonweal Theater in Lanesboro, Minnesota, a couple of years before that, and I got together for dinner. And we walked into the restaurant at, probably about 6:30. And it was just starting to snow when we walked into the restaurant. And by the time we left the restaurant, around 9 or 9:30, there was at least 6 inches of snow accumulated on the ground. And I come from a part of the country that gets winter, but it doesn't get that kind of winter, and certainly not on April 30th. And so I just kept thinking, oh my goodness, this is unnatural. I can't believe that I'm walking out into 6 inches of snow and tomorrow is the 1st of May. But that's when we started talking about it. And it wasn't too long after that that people in the city of Winona heard about these guys with this idea about starting a Shakespeare festival and got in touch with us and suggested we come to Winona to talk about establishing the festival here.
And you fell in love with it, obviously, right?
Well, we fell in love with the city's enthusiasm and their keen sense of what a Shakespeare festival could do for the town in terms of, generating, the economy, in terms of attracting tourism to the area. And I think, Winona is so unique. It's such a beautiful and unusual community. And people have a tendency to bypass it because Highway 61 runs along the bluffs, but to come into downtown Winona, where there's all this great architecture, where there's the waterfront, where there are so many things to see and to do, it's very easy not to get off the road and come into downtown. Mm-hmm. So something like, the Shakespeare Festival and now the Beethoven Festival, the Marine Art Museum, all of those things are giving more and more people reason to get off the highway and to come to Winona.
Now, let's talk about you personally. When did you realize that you were of the artistic fashion in theater? Like, when did that pique your interest?
The artistic fashion?
So to speak.
Well, I don't know that I've ever been fashionable, but I started in theater when I was a high school student, as I think so many people who have careers in the theater, do. And I was influenced, as many of us have been, by a really fine high school theater teacher who ran a really good program and was very inspiring. And that's, theater became a home for me. I was probably something of a misfit in high school, but, you always fit in the theater. Mm-hmm. It's a great, collector of all kinds of people and personalities, from misfits to the really popular kids. It just depends, And Shakespeare was the farthest thing from my mind for a long, long time because I just didn't get it. I couldn't read his plays and understand them. I had a lot of difficulty. But once I started performing in his plays, which I did my senior year of high school, it began to make sense to me in a whole new way because I was actually speaking the language. And I think that's one of the first steps we all need to take. I always recommend to students and to teachers that they read plays out loud, preferably in a group, but at least if they're working on them by themselves, to read the play out loud. It really catapults your understanding of the play to a whole new level. But after several years away from high school, I became a high school theater teacher myself. And it was at that time that I thought, you know, I really should know more about Shakespeare because, you know, there are a lot of plays out there and they're really good plays. And, you know, if I want to work with really good students and challenge them with really good writing, Shakespeare should be a part of that. So I went to the Oregon Shakespeare Festival and took a teacher's workshop, and it just completely turned my life around. I was seeing great plays by Shakespeare performed by a professional theater company and going to daily workshops, some of which were taught by members of the company, and it just really opened my eyes. I came back a much better teacher and introduced a lot of techniques that I picked up in that workshop into my own classrooms. I started directing Shakespeare with my high school students. And then a couple of years after that, when I realized that maybe I didn't want to teach high school for the rest of my life and there were other things I could be doing, I happened to move to Ashland, Oregon, and started working there in the box office of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, and then became the education director for the festival, and I did that for 8 years. So my acquaintance with Shakespeare has grown over a long period of time, and I always say to people, you know, it's an acquired taste. It's like, you know, oysters or liver or anything that seems foreign and a little strange to you at first. If you hang in there with it, it just gets easier and better all the time.
Now, did you do any acting per se yourself?
I did acting. I started with acting when I was a high school student and continued acting in college. Thought for a while that I was going to pursue acting as a career. But it was actually, without really knowing it, was always drawn to directing from the get-go. I think if any of my family were here participating in this interview, they would say I'd been directing them since about the age of 2. But it seemed my natural inclination, and it just took a while for me to realize that and figure out that that was, you know, the place in the theater that suited me the best, that and administration.
What's the draw to that?
Directing? Well, I think I have an inherent sense of the big picture and a knack for understanding what the small pieces are that will comprise a really great big picture. And I think I'm good at pulling together the people who can be responsible for the small parts that create the big picture, whether we're talking about actors, designers, or, you know, people who are running education programs or who are, you know, publicizing the festival, whatever their role is in the larger picture. I think I'm usually able to sense in people what their strengths are, what they do well, and pull them all together. And directing is all about seeing the big picture.
For you, putting together a play, how do you go about it? What's your process like? Take me through that.
Well, I always start with the play and the words of the play. And, you know, sometimes I get to choose the plays that I'm directing, and sometimes I get a call from a theater company that says, hey, we're looking for a director for this particular script, and, you know, are you available and interested? Usually the answer is yes, or, you know, a lot of the times it is. And I always hope when I get those phone calls that it's going to be a good script, that it's going to be good writing, because we're all better with good writing. Mm-hmm. Good writing makes all of our work that much easier. And most of the time you do get a good script to work on. Sometimes you don't, and that's where a lot of the craft of directing comes into play, because sometimes you're sort of working to shore up, you know, a weak link in a script, you know, however best you can. But basically, you know, I start with a story and figure out what it is we want to tell and what about it is compelling and how to make it clear. I think my fidelity is always to the playwright, and I think my job as director is to be the conduit from the playwright to the audience, working with a lot of collaborators along the way. But as a director, you always are the person who is, you know, making the final decision. So you've got to be open to collaboration, you've got to be open to input, and you've got to be unafraid to say, this is what we're doing, here's the bottom line. So it's, you know, you start with a kind of lonely period where you're getting acquainted with the script by yourself, and then you open the process up to more input, usually first of all from designers who will bring their ideas to the table, and together you sort of converse and argue and present various points of view and then come to a consensus of, you know, the way you're going to go with a particular production. And then the casting process happens, and then you get a lot of input from the actors once you get into rehearsal, who bring their own ideas. And it's always about helping them shape what they, you know, think is right or true, and matching it to what you think is right and true, and coming to, you know, whatever agreements you need to reach in that process.
There's a real balance there that you have to maintain.
Yep. Yep.
And I assume that in directing, that's probably one of the biggest challenges is maintaining this balance.
It's one of the things that is most challenging and most fun. And I think, you know, one of the things that we directors always need to keep in mind is that we ask a lot of actors in particular. I mean, we're really asking them to go out and be naked, not literally, usually, occasionally, but, you know, psychologically and spiritually and emotionally naked in front of a group of strangers. And that's a very vulnerable position to put somebody in. So I try to create an atmosphere in rehearsal that is safe and rigorous, in which it's perfectly okay to fall down and fail. I usually try to make a really big mistake really early on, so it's clear that making mistakes is permissible. And I think it's directing is so much the art of encouragement and bringing out of people the very best and making it possible for them to do their very best. So you're not putting people down for, you know, making a wrong choice or a silly choice or, you know, what might be perceived as a stupid choice. I don't think there are really such things. But it's to encourage them to bring to the table what they already know to do and are good at doing and then help them do more of it.
And there's a lot of experimentation.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of trial and error, and hopefully you have a rehearsal process and a time period in which trial and error can be part of that process. Sometimes, you know, you're putting together a play on very short schedules, and then you just have to bring your A game. You always have to bring your A game, but it's a different kind of A game. You have to have very clear goals for every rehearsal and always keep your eye on the bottom line, which is opening night, and making sure that you're shepherding the production in a way that will get to opening night gloriously.
Are you changing things all the way up to the end? Because like, when I had Alec in here, he says, oh, yeah, I do.
But. Yeah. Yes, you do change things all the way up to the end. I think in Alec's case with A Midsummer Night's Dream, they were making a lot of cuts and changes on the last rehearsal before opening night. I, you know, am unafraid to do that as well, if that's going to be necessary to the success of the production. And I also, you know, especially when you get into technical rehearsals, when you're adding the costumes and the lights and the sound, you know, that's a pretty compressed schedule. And I always try to make room for the designers to do their work without, you know, being right on top of them and saying, oh, wait a minute, I don't like that, or that's wrong, or can you do this? But letting them lay the foundation of their work, which means that my response to their work can sometimes come fairly late in the process. In the case of Henry IV, there's one scene in particular that after we had, I think, previewed the performance, the production, I thought was too dim and that the audience was having difficulty reaching the actors' faces, which I think is crucial. If you can't see the actors' faces, then you're cutting off mm-hmm. a large part of the story from the audience, no matter how beautiful the lighting cue may look, or you know, no matter how dark it's supposed to be, or dim, or threatening, or stormy, or whatever. If you can't see the actors, then you're not helping the audience into the story. So I gave a note to the lighting designer, and you know, we at the very last rehearsal, we just took a look at it and made some changes just to brighten it up a bit. So
I thought it looked beautiful. Every scene
Great.
Did. It
Thanks.
Really did. I got sucked into that whole
Great.
Scenery. What Lonnie and what Eric had done was really nice balance.
Oh, great.
With
great.
That.
Yeah, they're terrific designers, and it happens that we've worked together a lot. And so, you know, they both understand, you know, my particular taste and values. And Lonnie and I, in particular, have a really good shorthand. I can be sort of halfway out of my seat, turning to him to give him a note, and he'll just gesture to me and he'll nod. And I know that he knows exactly what I'm going to say and that he's already on it. So, and that's a great thing.
That's a beautiful thing. If yeah. you don't have to go into lengthy explanations for things, it makes things a lot quicker for you.
Yeah.
So what's your favorite part of the whole directing, and what's your favorite time? Like, is it opening night? Is it preview night? Is it?
Well, it changes a little bit. I mean, with every production, but I think my favorite time is when we get into the theater and I've got the designers and we're looking at the clothes under the lights, you know, with the sound and all of that, because you really get to see all of the pieces you've been talking about and working on for so many months come together as a whole. And you really get a sense of, you know, the unity and the fabric of the production. So that's probably my favorite time. I also like opening night, not for the reasons people might suspect, but because I think of it as the time for me to just kind of quietly slip out the back door feeling satisfied with the work that I've done. And, you know, it's a little bit like, I think, giving birth and, you know, giving something to the world and, you know, you get to send it off into its own life. And that so much of my work, I'm a freelance director much of the year, and, you know, I leave after opening night. So I'm very accustomed to entrusting whatever the child is, quote unquote, into the hands of the actors, the stage manager, and the audience. You know, it's theirs now. It's no longer mine. And I love that part of the process.
But here, you get to stay here throughout the whole season.
Oh, yes, I do. And I get to watch the work grow, and I try not to micromanage it. I try to stay away for several performances after it's open and then come back, take a look at the work. And then if I have any suggestions or notes, then I give them to the stage manager who gives them to the actors. And, you know, hopefully, no matter whether I stay or go, I've provided a very clear framework in which the actors can continue to live and breathe and move, and they know what direction to go in.
Has it ever been a hard thing to let it go?
I think when I was younger and newer to directing, it was, you know, and then I realized that, you know, all that was happening was I was completing one creative act, and I've been fortunate to move on to another creative act pretty regularly in my career as a director. So, and that's so much your job. I mean, you know, it is an act of creation, and if you're fortunate, you know, there's another one coming up. So I've gotten much better about it. And oftentimes, you know, when I come back to see it, production that's been running for a while, you know, it's so clearly theirs, and it's okay with me. I think that's as it should be, and it's always enjoyable, but I feel, in a healthy way, not terribly attached, interested, and willing to help if there's any cause for me to help, but not, oh my God, that's mine, you know, my child.
Don't ruin my baby.
Yeah, exactly.
How have you handled audience feedback in the past? Not just from things mm-hmm. here, but do you have any examples or stories that you think you have learned from feedback?
Well, audience feedback is always helpful and always interesting and always different. And it's one of the things that I love about live theater is that you and I could be sitting side by side in the same theater watching the same performance of the same production and have two very different responses to that performance, which I think is the glory of live theater. And I am always curious and interested to, you know, hear what people think or what they have responded to or felt, because sometimes it's something I've never even thought about, or in other cases, it may be something terribly helpful, like, I couldn't really hear that, you know, at which point, you know, oops, didn't do my job on that, need to make sure that they take more time with that moment or that line. And it's fascinating. And theater evokes a lot of passionate response in people. And, you know, sometimes discussions can get very heated. And I think that's a great thing. But as I said to somebody at a talk back at a theater in Utah a number of years ago, who was kind of offended at a particular production that I had directed. It's a Shakespeare play called Troilus and Cressida. And it's a magnificent play, but one that isn't done that often because it's pretty difficult. And, you know, it deals with war, it deals with sex, and it deals with ambiguity. And when I accepted the assignment, I told the producers of the company that those were the things that spoke to me in the play, and those are the things I was going to grapple with in the production. And if that was okay with them, then please do, you know, offer me the contract. But if that isn't the play that you want, you know, me to work on, then I think you need to look for a different director. But they said, no, that sounds great. We believe that to be true. So those were the things that I really worked on in the production. And a person who came to see the play commented in a discussion afterwards that I had managed to cross the line, you know, from entertainment into something else. And my response was, you know, first of all, that I think there are plays that are meant purely to entertain. I was at the time about to direct another production at this theater. It's a musical review that may be very familiar to people called Forever Plaid, which is just a great song fest for guys, beautiful music, great arrangements, lots of fun, lots of laughter. And I think, you know, there's a nice touching story in Forever Plaid, but I think basically it's there to entertain us. And I think that's a great thing. I think pure entertainment is a very valuable thing in our lives. But the thing that I said to the person who had commented about Troilus and Cressida was I said, you know, I've seen a lot of plays in my lifetime. I've seen plays that bored me to tears. I've seen productions that have made me laugh hysterically or made me weep or have moved me or exalted me or made me angry. But I don't think I've ever seen a play that damaged me. You know, I think I've seen plays that got me to question my assumptions about, you know, choices I've made in my own life or choices that other people have made in their lives or our lives. But I don't think I've ever seen a play that has damaged me. And so I don't think it's a bad thing that this didn't purely entertain, that it might have, you know, gotten somebody to think a little bit about war or whatever, you know.
Do you think people could end up in your profession picking a script and having it completely ruin their career?
I don't think so. I don't think there's such a thing as completely ruining a career unless you yourself have self-destructive tendencies that mm-hmm. make you difficult to work with. That will ruin a career if an actor has a particular personal problem that interferes with the work situation and makes them not reliable or not collaborative. Then, you know, eventually, it's a very, very competitive profession. There are many, many, many people who are drawn to this work and want to do this work. And there are lots of talented people out there. And eventually the people who have difficulties or are problematic to work with, no matter how talented they are or no matter, you know, how big a name they may have, they're going to fall by the wayside because too much time is wasted, too much emotion is spent, and it makes it too difficult. Nobody is getting rich doing this work.
Right.
And so it's really important that we find other ways to reward ourselves. And one of those is behaving professionally and being, just a great person to work with, which doesn't mean you have to agree with everything throughout the rehearsal process. But it means, you know, you engage in intelligent discussion, you argue for the points that you want to make. But, you know, you arrive on time, you're prepared to do the work, you complete your signed contract according to the duties outlined. It's pretty simple.
Now, I want to get into a little bit, coming back to the festival. When you were first putting this together and everything, I don't think people really have a good idea of what it takes to actually put together something that happens in such a short amount of time. Mm-hmm. Can you kind of give us some insight on that?
Well, it's enormous. And you're right. People really don't have a clue of how enormous it is and how long it takes. And this festival in particular has so many various components. It's kind of staggering. When we founded the company, we didn't want to be just a place where people would come to see a couple of plays. We wanted there to be a real festival. We wanted guest speakers coming in. We, you know, love the sense of the Midwestern front porch where, you know, people gather to tell the stories of their lives, in essence. And we wanted this festival, which is so rooted in the Midwest, to reflect that. We wanted there to be music. So we have our free Concerts on the Green series. Now, those concerts happen to be mostly managed and put together by one of our great collaborative partners, and that's Theater du Mississippi, which is a local theater group that's been around longer than the festival has. And they do a lot of music presentation throughout the year. They're also very involved in the Frozen River Film Festival. But the concerts are just one whole entity, and that takes an enormous number of people alone, just finding the artists, booking the artists, promoting the artists for that, scheduling them, and working with management at the festival to make sure we're coordinating it all. But that's just one component of the festival. We do an enormous amount of education programs. We have our Shakespeare for Young Actors program that just started the other day. We have our Apprentice Actor Training Program, which will perform King Lear along with our interns the last week of the season. And we do Chill with Will nights at the theater for groups of young people. There are any number of workshops and classes that, you know, we get requests for and try to fulfill. So education is a huge part of the festival as well. There's the whole, I don't think people, you hear it quoted a lot, but I don't think people really get that for every actor on stage, every actor an audience member sees on stage, there are at least four, if not five people working somewhere behind the scenes to make it possible for them to do what they do. And that includes, you know, an expansive run crew for the productions, the people who are changing the sets, the people who are running the lights and the sound, the people who are applying the blood to the actors backstage, and then washing the costumes after every performance of Henry IV. Moore Part One, maintaining them, making sure they're ready for the next performance. I mean, it's huge what goes on here. And, you know, we have an acting company of about 18 and a total company of about 100 people. So the ratio really is 5 to 1.
And a lot of times people relate to hours, right? If they don't understand certain things. So like how many hours would you say are put into the, yeah, I know, right? The loaded question there.
It's you know, you can't really count them. You know, and I'm, for myself, am fond of saying to people, you know, from the moment I arrive in Winona to begin rehearsals for the season to the day I walk out the door, you know, I just don't plan on sitting down. This is probably the longest I've sat in one place for weeks.
Are you okay with that?
Yeah, I'm fine with that, actually. And it's a bit of an exaggeration, but, you know, we put in very, very long days. Now, you know, that's one reason why we have unions. You know, I'm governed by the terms of the director's union. So, you know, there are certain contractual stipulations simply as a director that I, you know, am guided by. Just as the 8 actors in our company who are members of Actors Equity are governed by the rules of that union. And they're very, very specific for very, very good reason. You know, we don't want to exploit anyone. And it's very easy in this business to exploit people because people generally love the work that they do and they want to do it and they want to do it well. But we also need to guard against our own best instincts or our own worst instincts of, you know, kind of being our own worst enemy by saying yes to so many things that we end up not sleeping a lot or not staying rested and healthy. You know, I think there was perception or a stereotype of actors and theater people, you know, 20, 30 years ago about, oh, well, they all drink, they all smoke, you know, they're up all night, you know, they don't get any sleep. Actors are the healthiest people I know. They eat really right, really well. They run, they work out. You know, we have many actors who have joined the Wellness Center here on campus at Winona State or go to the Y. You know,
I see them biking around the lake.
They bike around the lake. And that's because acting is a rigorous, demanding profession. You know, and you have to be at the top of your game in order to do what it asks of you vocally and physically. And, you know, just to maintain that lifestyle, you know, takes a lot. So, you know, that's a stereotype that has largely gone by the wayside. Certainly within the theater world, I don't know about the rest of the public, because I think, you know, I mean, since Shakespeare's days, you know, actors were considered lowlifes, you know, no better than robbers, thieves, you know, whores, prostitutes, you know, that sort of thing. And, you know, you just weren't ever supposed to enter the profession. And, you know, a lot of that has lingered, although I think it has much more to do with the economics of being an actor right now than anything else. It's not the highest paid profession in the world, in spite of what you hear about Tom Cruise's salary. So we're not in that category. So,
more of a labor of love?
It's a labor of love, but also, you know, one of the things that we work hard at is paying people for the work that they do. Because, you know, why shouldn't artists, you know, be paid a living wage? I mean, what they do is very, very hard work, and the contribution they make to society, I think, is an important one. I think there's a whole thing about the arts in this country in particular, where there is no real state subsidy of the arts the way there is in Europe, for instance, that, well, you know, it's not really profitable business. It's not really a good capitalistic enterprise, you know, and they like what they do. So why should they be paid? You know, I think the perception of work in this country is that you've got to work at something that you don't really enjoy doing.
But
you can make a lot of money doing it. But, you know, you shouldn't really enjoy your work. And, you know, generally we enjoy our work. Now, why we shouldn't get paid to do something that we enjoy doing, you know, that's a question that we're not going to find the answer to, you know, anytime soon. It's an ongoing question, but it's also at the root of, you know, the arts in America.
Well, it's funny because when I wanted to do what I wanted to do, which is work in a creative field, my mom's like, always have plan B. Mm-hmm. Always have plan B.
Yeah.
You know, what's going to happen. I support you 100% fully, but... Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My dad, after 9/11, and he was in his early 90s at that time, and he's always been, he was always tremendously supportive and very proud of my accomplishments. But he said to me, he said, well, you know, now that this has happened, you know, what are you in these non-essential professions going to do? And I thought, non-essential profession? I'm in an essential profession. And, you know, fortunately, there's still been work even after, you know, 9/11. Another, an actor who's a very good friend who is based in New York, after the economy really began to crash, he had had a conversation with his mom, who was very concerned about what was happening to their stock portfolio. And, you know, he was trying to assure her that, you know, just we're going to get through this no matter what. And, you know, we were commenting to each other as we walked to rehearsal, this really doesn't feel that much different, you know, than life before the economy tanked, because, you know, actors and directors are always looking for their next job. You know, you work for 6 weeks or 8 weeks or 6 months, you know, and then you're looking for your next job. And the art of being a professional actor or director is being ahead of the game and on top of it, so that if you are looking for work, you're looking for work in another year or two, but not in another month or two.
Yeah, that's frightening.
Yeah. Well, it's frightening, but it's also part of the game. And, you know, I mean, you just, you know, you either accept it as being a part of what it is we do, a nature of the profession, or you decide not to do it.
Right.
So.
Exactly. Well, thanks so much for taking the time and giving us your insight. It's been wonderful.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of ArtBeat with Paul Barnes.
ArtBeat is written and produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University. Visit us on the web at kqal.org.